The end of 2025 will see Matt Stringer leaving RNIB as their chief exec. It's been an exciting time, probably a tumultuous time as well. So we thought we'd sit down with him and look back over his time here at the helm of the good ship RNIB. Matt, thank you very much for joining us.
No, my pleasure, Alan. Good to speak to you.
So, Matt, let's go way back. You have a commercial background, retail and so on. What attracted you then to come into the third sector?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've done 30 years in retail, had the opportunity to leave the job I was in at the time. I'd always had a sort of, without trying to appear too cliched, a sort of philanthropic bent. I'd done a lot of coaching and volunteering and stuff like that for kids' sports teams and various things, and just thought there was a different track for the next stage of my career, and the charity sector was an obvious place to go and have a look for another role, if honest. And the RNIB job, the application process was open. I thought it looked a good fit. Yeah, very respected brand, lots of heritage. One that I, from the outside, had some understanding of, certainly being market leading, clearly, in the space it occupied. And so it seemed a good fit. And then I found out a bit more about some of the challenges that it was facing. And I think realised through the sort of application process that it was a job I probably was quite well suited for. And thankfully, Ellie Southwood, the chair at the time, the trustees thought the same. And here I am 7 years later, having done it and about to leave it. But that was the way it came about.
When you go into a new job, or anyone goes into a new job, something like a chief exec role anyway, you see the job adverts, you learn a bit about the organisation. It's not really until you've perhaps been offered a job and you have day one that you look at some of the things that need to be done, some of the good points, some of the bad points as well. Was it a bit of a baptism of fire for you?
I knew I was coming into statutory inquiry and all the challenges that were around that. It meant the organisation had to make a lot of improvements on a number of fronts, some of the well-documented fronts around safeguarding, governance, had to bring a bit of financial control back, recover the finances, and then you start to look around where we are, how are we doing it. So I think the statutory inquiry was a very involved challenge that took us over 2 years, 2.5 years in essence, to sort of get out of or get through. Probably in retrospect, you know, necessarily cathartic experience for not only me, but some new exec members and new trustees who joined at the time, all putting their shoulder to the wheel to get us through what was a sticky period, and COVID hit in the second year of that. So that was another challenge. I think on the other side of it, though, on day one, moved by quality of what we were doing, the support we were giving to our beneficiaries, really giving me the chance to get round in my first X months, ECLOs and our buildings, and see our helpline and our sight loss advice service and our reading services, and really see how hundreds of thousands of people a year were benefiting from an interaction with the RNIB, which would make their life measurably worse if we weren't there. And so whilst we had all the challenges on sort of one side that took us a couple of years to get through, on the other side, really positive sense of purpose and mission and opportunity from the really good work we were doing day in, day out.
Was it a steep learning curve for you? Because, you know, as you said, you're out there straight away, you're going around the estate, if you like, so you're learning about the services and indeed the people the charity is there to support.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think the no bit will be the maybe slightly more two-dimensional practical bit. Running a big retailer, you're used to multifaceted operations. You know, you're running stores, you're running a website, you're running a warehouse, you're running supply chain, you've got a lot of people, you've got suppliers, you have customers, in a way we have beneficiaries. So, you know, the RNIB is quite a big business, really, a big organisation. You know, all those services I've mentioned, we have representation in England and the devolved nations, Gateshead, Peterborough, ECLOs in 100-plus hospitals. You know, we're quite a complex beast, necessarily. And so that felt quite normal, honestly. I mean, clearly I had to understand exactly what we were doing in all those places. But I think the bit that was more of a learning curve, I think, was the more visceral nature of it, really understanding the challenges you're visually impaired, why our services mattered, really understanding at a sort of almost individual level how we were supporting and transforming lives in a way that goes beyond retailer to customer relationship. A beneficiary of the RNIB has a much more deep-rooted need to have a relationship with us and someone buying a jumper from Marks and Spencer, you know. So I think that bit, whilst I understood the nature of our operations and the fact we had a lot of customers and beneficiaries, I think when you really get into why and what we were doing and the difference it makes, that's the bit that I, you know, really learnt, in essence, I think, really understood over the first sort of year in the role, getting out and about and really spending some time with the teams and sort of understanding that. And that's absolutely critical, frankly. I know it was critical getting out the statutory inquiry, but I think as critical was understanding why we do what we do.
You mentioned the statutory inquiry, which you came into as well, guiding the organisation through that. It wasn't very long after that. COVID was here. We were going into lockdown as well. Probably not only a bit of a still a learning curve for yourself, but some massive changes that the RNIB and other charities were basically thrown into as well.
Almost overnight, wasn't it? Everything suddenly seemed to accelerate very quickly in the spring of 2020, and suddenly by March, second week of March, we were sort of locking down, weren't we? Yeah, look, I think proudest moment almost of time at the RNIB, I think, that year, because as you say, we were sort of contending with doing the hard yards of sort of getting through the statutory inquiry, trying to sell out of our regulated services at the time. And then we had to get the organisation set up to be able to operate through COVID. And that in itself, it was a challenge in a sense that people's day-to-day rhythms sort of changed almost overnight. Everyone was working from home. You know, did our technology support that? Could you have Teams meetings? How were we supporting people in a different routine? You know, both practically around technology and sort of psychologically as well around feelings of maybe loneliness, and how did that all work? So that was a big challenge for the organisation, and financial concerns, you know, was the bottom going to fall out of our fundraising because everyone suddenly felt that they were going to be harbouring their assets, you know, and we couldn't run events and couldn't communicate and all those sorts of things. So quite a lot of anxiety and uncertainty whilst you're setting the organisation up to cope, which, you know, would have been shared by every organisation that had to do that. And this is, again, the most critical point was our beneficiaries, those people that relied on us, suddenly having their routines uprooted by the fact that they couldn't go into services. You know, they were having to access stuff remotely, loneliness, and also challenge societal challenges because of COVID. So if you're visually impaired, suddenly you're thinking, well, I'm not too sure I can adhere to distancing rules. We're getting daily press conferences from Number 10. They're not accessible. I don't know what's going on. You know, I've got a testing process which isn't accessible. How do I know I've got COVID? I'm nervous about going out because I'm not meant to. And yet I'm worried about things like getting food deliveries to me when as soon as a supermarket puts its delivery slots up, everyone just latches onto them and they've gone in a nanosecond type thing. How am I going to cope with that? And so all the things we ultimately talked to at the COVID inquiry a year ago around the challenges, and all these things were layers on layers on layers. The cumulative nature of some of these challenges was really punishing, I think, for lots of disabled people and lots of visually impaired people. So I think we very quickly realised that, and I think probably one of our finest hour of my time, I think, was the way we spent probably the first three to six months when it was all a bit uncertain, responding to those challenges and getting the organisation galvanised behind some critical interventions around accessible comms, around accessibility of resources, food being a particular one, around trying to improve testing and ultimately vaccination processes, you know, all of which we did a pretty good job on, actually. I think that's why it's probably one of our finest hours of recent times was that first year of COVID.
RNIB, like many charities, has had to watch the coffers, looking at what it can do with the money it has, growing that fundraising as well. You know, and like other charities, you know, RNIB has had to make some difficult decisions. Is that tough as a chief executive to look at the bottom line, especially when you're balancing money with impact of services as well?
Every organisation, whether charities, businesses, you know, the last few years coming out of COVID, the cost of living crisis, inflation was running at 11% at one point, wasn't it? You know, now through the last couple of years, some of the current challenges within the UK economy, it's not easy. Costs are going up. Inflation's, what, 4% now, has been higher. Fundraising's harder because people are nervous about giving money to causes, and generationally, people change some of their giving habits as well. So you're sort of trying to cope with that and get your head around that again. So at the end of the day, you've got to cut your cloth to make sure you're viable and sustainable going forwards for the benefit of your, in our case, your beneficiaries. I mean, the RNIB needs to be here for hundreds of thousands of people a year that rely on our services. And we have to make sure we're constantly keeping the organisation set up in a way that can support our beneficiaries, whilst also being very alert to our duty to our colleagues as well, and trying to make sure we communicate change and deliver change in a way which is certainly understandable and well communicated, even if ultimately maybe there are some challenging messages in there for how an organisation might change. So it goes with the territory. I mean, every organisation's had to do it. We're not alone or unique at all. And I think we probably did a good job of facing into it reasonably early in what was going to be a challenging era. I do understand it's very tough on our colleagues who've been affected by it, and tough on those who've stayed through it and had to sort of change maybe in their patch a little bit in terms of how we were set ourselves up. I think the critical thing is making sure the RNIB is there for the future for those hundreds of thousands of people we support and try and do all the good stuff we've done to sort of inform national processes and improve the national condition for visually impaired people, to make the lives of 2 million visually impaired people better in the UK by the RNIB being a sustained and impactful organisation. And that's why we've made the changes.
Would you say in your time here as well, RNIB, I suppose along with other charities as well, have had to look at things in a more corporate way, partnerships, but policy and campaigning becoming quite a mainstay here as well, almost, you know, looking for the government and society to take a bit more responsibility around things?
It's a balance, Alan. We speak every week, don't we, about what we've been doing, and I think if people look back at all our interviews, they'd find a balance or from week to week, things undulating as we touch on different things. Look, I think our services are a massive bedrock for us now. Could you argue someone else could deliver our reading services? Well, maybe, but we have established that over probably about 100 years, actually, our reading services from post the First World War, and no one else is going to do it anytime soon. So it becomes a bit of an orthodoxy, but it's one that we're very proud of, and we want to maintain, as we do, for example, eye care liaison officers in 132 hospitals, I think it is now, pretty much 95% coverage of the UK in terms of having an ECLO on hand for someone going through an eye health diagnosis. And that's a massively important service, not only for, I think this year we've seen 72,000 people through our ECLOs, our eye care liaison officers. It gives us great insight and great validity to then go and inform, as you said, some of those big national questions and trying to campaign and inform policy around eye health, around employment, around education, comes from the fact that we know what we're talking about because we have those services and those beneficiaries who we can just see in real time, and we're getting real time feedback about what's working, what isn't, in a way that I think anyone else in the UK has that level of insight, frankly. And I think our biggest wins in the last couple of years have been because we've been able to pivot or transition between service delivery and getting that benefit and that validity and that insight from that, and being able to take that and inform our policy positions and being able to build those relationships with external agencies, whether government, NHS, etc., and get noticed because we've got something to say and we have the validity to say it.
Right at the start of your time as Chief Exec, Matt, I remember there was a meeting and that people could join in on, and one of the things you were saying was, you know, a chief exec or the leadership team should be out there. They should be going around England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and seeing what's going on, speaking to beneficiaries, speaking to staff as well. That's something you seem to have clung to throughout your time, is being out there at the helpline, listening into calls, going around the offices as well. Something, again, I suppose, which is very important to you personally.
It's massively important. I think, yes, of course, you can sit in an office and there's stuff you can do from your desktop. But equally, I just mentioned validity. I think your validity individually comes from being seen and being involved, immersed in what we do on a day-to-day basis. And I learned so much going around, you know, as you say, go to Peterborough, talk to the helpline, see who's calling, what they're calling about. Go up to Gateshead, talk to the teams up there about what we're doing and how we're printing materials, and sit there, as I would last time I was there, stuffing an envelope with people's discs for their reading services and USB sticks, and sitting there doing that and seeing, you know, frankly, all those people, all those addresses who rely on the RNIB for that service. You know, going around the devolved nations, we've seen each other a lot in Scotland. You know, Hillside is a massive beacon for us in Edinburgh, which gives us a great platform or great venue to serve lots of visually impaired people, certainly across the Central Belt in Scotland, but also great vantage point to engage with Holyrood and other providers, NHS, in Edinburgh Eye Hospital, all those things we've been up there talking about. So getting out and about is massively important. It's a bit of the job I enjoyed the most, frankly. And again, with my retail background, that sense of being on the shop floor, seeing what's going on with products, talking to customers, is so much more valuable, or as valuable as what you see reading a report in an office. And actually, the bringing of the two together, the sort of real life experience on the front line with what the reports and the data you're getting in the centre is a powerful combination to really work out what's going on.
And even on that front line, Matt, you've been out there on the pitch, if you like, trying your hand at blind football.
Bit of blind football in Birmingham. I think I scored a goal playing with the West Brom coaches from the blind football team. But done the kilt walk up in Scotland with David Clark and James Adams back when I started, did the 24 miles of that, and London Marathon in 2021, as well as various double dashes and sponsored running. So, yeah, certainly been roped in by the teams to contribute athletically and raise a bit of money along the way.
What made you decide that perhaps your time at RNIB was going to come to an end now, maybe time to move on to something else?
Yeah, I mean, nothing desperately sinister. I've done 7 years. I think CEO job's a big one, can be quite a lonely one. We spend a lot of energy and effort. Clearly, we've had some challenges, as we've talked about in this interview, you know, both the first couple of years of getting out of some challenging times, and then maybe the last 3 or 4 years, really trying to drive forwards and take advantage of the reset organisation, you know, building those external relationships and trying to inform some of those big national questions we've touched on around the NHS, around employment, for example, around education, travel and transport. And I've done 7 years, and that's probably almost long enough, I think, for a CEO. I think these are big jobs and probably get a bit spent after a bit. I think we're not in a bad spot at the moment. We've come through, as your question has attested, a transformation programme. We've got a plan for the future. We're in reasonable shape in terms of financially. We've got a fair bit of money in the bank at the moment through what we've managed to do to reset the property portfolio, with a bit more to come. And we've just done a bit of work this year on what the future might look like for the organisation, which we discussed at the most recent board meeting. So it's a good time, I think, now to sort of hand it over to someone who can come and take it on for the next cycle, which I think we're getting into. If I stayed a bit longer, I'd have slightly compromised or been working on that next cycle, and then handing it over partially way through didn't seem the best thing. So 7 brilliant years, loved it, but good to know when it's time to hand over, actually, and don't overstay your welcome. I think we've probably got to that point, and very pleased to be handing over to Simon Antrobus, who will start in January.
What would you say, that's probably difficult to say one thing, but what do you think you'll miss not being CEO of RNIB anymore?
It won't be the status and the governance and the, you know, the hierarchy of it all. I'll miss being on the front line. I mean, it's taught me a heck of a lot, honestly, which I wouldn't have picked up in retail. You know, I'm very bothered about customer in my retail career, but I think coming into the RNIB has taught me so much, I think, about how the country doesn't really work for disabled people. Not deliberately, it's just unthinking and lack of prioritisation as opposed to any deliberate decisions people are taking. And I think I've learned a heck of a lot about that, and being out, you know, as you said, on the sort of metaphorical shop floor, speaking to beneficiaries, volunteers, colleagues, and really seeing what's going on has been the highlight of my time. You know, I love getting out into all those locations we've talked to and actually speaking to the colleagues and seeing what's happening on the front line, and that's the bit I will miss the most.
What's next then for Matt Stringer after you leave on your final day? What's the plan for the future?
The immediate plan is have a nice Christmas with my family who are coming home for about a week or so over Christmas. And then my wife and I are heading off, I think, towards a well-known trip in the organisation. We're off to Australia for 3 weeks, which I've never done. Ulterior motive to watch a bit of Ashes cricket, which series will be long since gone by the time I get there for the fifth test. But good to be in Sydney. I think I've never been to Australia. And then back at the end of January into real life post RNIB. I think a few non-exec things. I've just picked up a trusteeship at the RNID earlier this year, which I'm really enjoying. A few other irons in the fire like that. So I think, without saying a horribly cliched sort of portfolio career answer, because that would be far too sort of considered and thoughtful, just doing a few things like that where I feel I can put something back, as I have enjoyed at the RNIB. And in addition to other things, probably occupy the time. One, contemplating going back and doing a master's degree. I never did first time round, so I've got my eye on the sort of international relations degree, which I need to, as my wife keeps telling me, get on with and apply, which I haven't done yet. And then we'll probably get another dog as well, because our dog died earlier this year, and I think we've had time to grieve our dog. And next year, a bit more time to get another dog, which we would both, my wife and I would both love doing.
Your time is coming to an end here at RNIB, and I think especially for us here at RNIB Connect Radio, you know, you've been a bit of an integral part of our output every week as well, and a huge supporter of the radio station, so we'll certainly miss your presence. So don't be a stranger. You know how to listen to us, you know how to keep in touch with us. And for the final time, Matt, good luck, and thank you for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
No, Alan, my pleasure. I've loved speaking to you every week, you and the team. It's been a great highlight of my time. I really value the channel. We need to do more with it, as we're talking about at the moment. It's a great medium to be able to communicate to people, and it's been good to get to know all of you on the Collect Radio channel. So thank you for having me.